From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. There's a new book out this month that tells the story of the man who was piloting the container ship that hit the Old Sunshine Skyway Bridge in 1980. The freighter Summit Venture hit the bridge during a freak storm, taking one of the spans down into the water. Here's his mayday call.
All emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. Vessels just hit the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. Get all emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. There's a mayday. Emergency situation. Stop the traffic on that Skyway Bridge.
7 cars and a Greyhound bus fell over the edge, killing 35 people. We'll speak to the author about what really happened that fateful day. Plus, the 7th annual symposium on harmful algae blooms in the U.S. comes to Sarasota at the end of the month. We'll take a closer look at research into the effects of red tide in southwest Florida. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Amy Tardiff. Thanks for joining us. The end of the month marks Mote Marine Laboratory's 7th annual symposium on harmful algae in the U.S., which brings research scientists from all over the country to Sarasota. Coming up in about half an hour, we'll get the latest on algal bloom research with a close look at red tide blooms. But first, the first span of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge across Tampa Bay went up in 1954. It was considered an engineering marvel and was state-of-the-art for its time. It lasted for more than 34 years. The twin span, which took traffic southbound toward Fort Myers, went up in 1971 when Walt Disney World opened. Engineers did not use the best construction or protection from the shipping vessels in Tampa Bay on that span. 9 years later, on May 9, 1980, during a freak storm, a 600-foot freighter crashed into that span of the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, bringing it down. 35 people, whose vehicles, including a Greyhound bus, plunged into the water and died. There's a new book out this month about the tragic accident. It tells the story of the man who was piloting the ship through the harbor that day, as well as some of the people who lost their lives and the one survivor. It also reveals problems with the bridge's construction, its lack of lights, the freak storm that overtook the ship without any warning from the Weather Service, and other details that contributed to the accident. Joining us to talk about his book, Skyway, the True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down, is Bill DeYoung. He's senior writer and arts and entertainment editor for Connect Savannah. DeYoung was also a journalist and editor at several Florida newspapers for 26 years. Thanks so much for joining us today, Bill.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And listeners can join our conversation by calling 1-877-428-8255. That is 1-877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Bill, when did you first ride across the Skyway?
Oh, I must have been 4 years old. My goodness, I was born in 1958. I'm an old guy, so my parents had moved down from Chicago. I was born in Florida, and crossing the Skyway was something you just got used to. I was always, I should point out, terrified as a little child. Those who remember that bridge and that sort of roller coaster ascent of that bridge, very frightening. I was a little kid.
So why did you write the book, and how long had you been thinking about doing it before you actually began?
Well, my history is as a music journalist, entertainment and particularly music. I thought about this a lot. I'd like to sort of say it came out of completely nowhere, but I'm not sure that that's true. I probably was always looking for something long form to do. And I had a couple of music books that got started a couple of times over the years and didn't sort of pan out. This just sort of jumped out at me, and I started reading about it. I lived there when it happened. I was 21 when it happened. And I, for whatever reason, started reading about it without thinking this was going to be a book project. But I found that I couldn't put down what I read, and I also found that what I read contradicted many of the other things that had been written about it. There was no complete sort of true narrative of the whole thing. And I wanted to set that right for history's sake, if nothing else.
How tricky was it to pilot a freighter under the old bridge on a clear day?
On a clear day, apparently not too difficult. Tampa Bay's average depth is 12 or 13 feet. So it falls to these guys who are piloting these freighters and the container ships and everything else, the big vessels that go through here, to stay in the channel, the dredge channel. It's very clearly marked, and on a good day, it's not a problem at all. It's not. We have video that from the 1970s that a TV station did that basically follows the ship through and under the bridge, and it's a beautiful day, and it's not a single problem. You know, they're all just laughing and joking. You know, it's a very different thing when you have complete and utter blackness descend on you when you're less than a mile from the bridge, and that's what happened to Captain Laro.
Was the southern span pushed through quickly to be ready for Disney's opening day?
That's kind of my theory. I think that when you look at the Department of Transportation memos from that period, it had a lot to do with making the Skyway part of the interstate highway system. You couldn't do it with a two-lane bridge, so it had to be four-lane. This was Hayden Burns, the governor's idea. Now, Hayden Burns happened to be, if you pardon the expression, in bed with Disney. He was a big proponent of that. And everybody in those days knew that Florida was going to change dramatically when Disney came in. So it's sort of my belief that Governor Burns rushed it through, yeah, and they cut a lot of corners. It's always been my belief that he did that to make it more interstate friendly, you know, because they knew that the tourism was going to change dramatically. Yeah.
Cracks were discovered early on due to cost-cutting measures like drilling the foundation pilings into sand instead of bedrock and using concrete instead of steel to make the pilings. So how much did this contribute to the bridge crumbling when the ship hit it?
Well, it's funny. When you talk to pilots, inevitably the guys who are around then, who are still around now, will say, well, you know, that bridge just fell apart like a box of cornflakes, you know, cornflakes popping out and... That's the way they described it. I think it's important to remember, though, that it was a direct hit from 20,000 tons of steel on one of its concrete piers that brought the bridge down. I think had it been made of solid gold, that impact would have taken it down anyway. So I don't know that the fact that it was rather shabbily built really contributed to that. I'm not sure that one can make that argument.
But Summit Venture was not the first boat to hit the bridge. How much? No. So it had some prior damage to it, too.
Those of us who know the Sunshine Skyway that's there now, you see how incredibly well protected it is. They spent $41 million to put those concrete bumpers around. From the very beginning, from 1954, neither of the early spans had any sort of protection at all. The bridge had been clipped a couple of times, nothing this massive, obviously, but it always struck me that it was kind of an accident waiting to happen. It was kind of a miracle that it didn't happen before 1980. It was just a confluence of circumstances that made this happen on that particular day.
We're talking with author and journalist Bill DeYoung. He's out with a new book about the Sunshine Skyway disaster. Our phone number is 877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255, and we're on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Now, John Laro, the harbor pilot assigned to the Summit Venture, was a veteran merchant mariner who'd been in the Tampa Bay Pilots Association for 3 years. He'd gone under the bridge almost 1,000 times. Why was he not liked by his fellow harbor pilots?
Well, to find that out, you go back to 1975, which is when... The Florida legislature created what's called the Board of Pilot Commissioners under the Department of Professional Regulation. There had been a lot of complaints over the years about cronyism and nepotism in the ranks of the Florida Harbor Pilots. So, in effect, the state took over hiring the pilots from the pilots groups. John was the very first hire. John came from New York, and a lot of those guys, so we can't say all of them, because he certainly did have some friends in the group, but they were very polarized, especially in those days, the pilot groups. A lot of them just didn't like the guy and resented him from the day he got there because he was an outsider. You know, he was a New Yorker. He liked classical music. He'd been a ballet dancer in college.
But it wasn't
so
to do with his...
do the math there.
It didn't have to do with his Did it have to do with his work ethic?
What I found was you would find about half the guys would say he was fine, he was just as good as the rest of us, and then the other guys would say he was terrible. We always knew something was going to happen. A lot of the guys,
but that was hindsight.
Were pilots in those days are gone now, so I didn't have the opportunity to sort of talk to them among the ones who were still around or who had commented on it at the time. It was sort of split up the middle.
The Summit Venture was 600 feet long, 80 feet wide, a 30-man Chinese crew. It was heading to shore to be filled with phosphate. And this freak storm forms when the ship's a bit less than a mile from the Skyway. What, with all that going on, what did Lero do wrong?
He had very little time to make a crucial decision. The wind was from his stern. It was coming from the southwest and sort of pushing him towards the bridge. Now, had he made a turn right, if you will, then it was a light ship, as you say. It was going to pick up phosphate. So
it was empty.
He would have presented a broadside to that wind, which he knew in that shallow water probably would have pushed him into the Skyway anyway. He could have gone left. He could have gone to port and circled around in the channel. He had enough room. But there was a gasoline tanker that he knew coming from the other side of the bridge that was just likely to be in the channel at that moment. So he had to make a decision, and the radar went out. Oh, my God, what do I do? But then the co-pilot says, I have the radar. We're in the right place, and the radar disappeared again. This was a black storm, with just a cell that was really, it's like that guy in Little Abner with the little black cloud following him around. So he had about 30 seconds to decide what to do. Once the lookout on the bow said, I see a buoy, and once the radar had cleared, I see a buoy, he said, I know where we are. He had to make an 18-degree turn to go onto the spans of the bridge. Now, what happened is that the wind changed direction. The storm was unbelievable. So by the time he starts making the turn, it's pushing him to the south, and he couldn't see anything. And as it turned out, the oil tanker had anchored on the other side of the bridge, and he didn't hear the radio call saying, I'm anchoring, you can turn around. It was just it was a tight spot. It was a confluence of bad mojo, as they say.
At 7:34 a.m. that day, the starboard bow grazed the second-highest support pier of the southbound bridge, shearing off both concrete columns. The bridge came down in sections, sort of like dominoes. Lero said it was like cornflakes falling out of a box.
Yeah.
Vehicles fell 150 feet into the water, and Lero called for a mayday. Let's listen to part of that call.
Mayday, 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 Coast Guard, mayday, 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 Coast Guard.
Vessel calling, mayday, vessel in distress. This is United States Coast Guard, St. Petersburg, Florida. Request your position, nature of distress, and number of persons on board. Over.
This is it. All the emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. Vessel just hit the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. Get all emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge. The Skyway Bridge is down. There's a mayday. Emergency situation. Stop the traffic on that Skyway Bridge.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what size is the vessel that hit the bridge? Over.
The large vessel. Stop the traffic on the Skyway Bridge. There are some people in the water. Get emergency equipment out to the Skyway Bridge now.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what vessel are you on? Over.
Some adventure.
Adventure, Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, what is the size of your vessel and can you assist? Over.
Cannot assist. We're 606 feet long, light draft. We cannot assist. We are in our apartment. Stop all the traffic on the bridge. Send some vessels out here to render assistance. People are on fire.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger.
This is Roger, Coast Guard, St. Petersburg, 22.
Negative. Stay on 16. Pass all traffic on 16. Break. Pon. Hello, all stations. This is United States Coast Guard, St. Petersburg, Florida. Silence is imposed on this frequency. Say launch mayday. Silence is imposed on this frequency. This is United States Coast Guard, St. Petersburg, Florida. Out.
This is Project Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. I'm dropping anchor on bars and we'll be headed for the bridge to assist. Predict the target. 5241.
This is Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, may I have the name of your vessel again, please, over.
The Chug Dixie Progress.
Progress, Coast Guard, St. Petersburg. Roger, please advise me when you're on scene and the number of people you pick up out of the water. There is a report that there are people in the water.
That was the Mayday call made by Harbor Pilot John Laro on the morning of May 9th, 1980, when the ship he was driving, Summit Venture, hit the Old Sunshine Skyway Bridge, taking down the southbound span, killing 35 people. The entire call is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Our guest is the author of a new book about the tragedy called Skyway, The True Story of Tampa Bay's Signature Bridge and the Man Who Brought It Down, Bill DeYoung. Get in touch with him by calling 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Or email us at gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Bill, what was it like for the folks driving on the bridge that morning?
Well, couldn't see a thing, obviously. What was interesting for me was to discover the this technically took place in Hillsborough County, so we got the whole Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department report, including the testimony from all those who stopped in time or had just gone over when it happened. To answer your question, it was pretty awful. The Greyhound bus was the last vehicle over. It inverted and took, I think, somewhere between 2 and 2.5 seconds to hit the water. It was not good. I'm not sure what I can say. It was pretty scary.
Did experts think the people who went over and hit the water knew what was happening?
Well, I can tell you, Amy, that the search and rescue team described the looks on people's faces to me as they recovered the bodies, and yeah, I think they knew what was happening to them. Pretty sad stuff. But Mr. McIntyre, Wesley McIntyre, of course, was the only survivor. His vehicle was the first one over. It's a very dramatic story. He went down with the road and smacked against the hull of the ship and then sunk to the bottom of the shipping channel. The only survivor. He was the first one. Everybody after that died.
Yeah, you call his chapter The Only Fool Who Went in the Water. Before you tell us more about Wesley, can you please read from the beginning of his chapter?
Oh, sure. I'm happy to do that, actually. How funny. I actually have it open right here. Okay. This is The Only Fool Who Went in the Water. Wesley McIntyre woke up suddenly as if jolted from a nightmare with a pounding headache, blood running down his face, and a terrifying sense of claustrophobia. The air was close. He was cold and soaking wet. It took him a few seconds to remember that he'd just been looking straight into the unforgiving steel hull of a master ship. Had he dreamed it? Where the hell was he? Then he noticed the green water pouring into the space where his windshield had been, and bubbles rising in steady streams from the battered hood of his little truck, which seemed to be parked at a curious angle. The headlights were still on. He was at the bottom of the shipping channel, the truck's rear end planted in the silt, 40 feet beneath the surface of Tampa Bay. His little truck's fall had been broken by the port bow of some adventure. Frantically, McIntyre forced open the top part of the damaged driver's side door until he'd made enough room to wiggle through. The water stung, and the escape route was tight. His Navy survival training from 40 years before came rushing back. Filling his lungs one last time, McIntyre pushed his 220-pound frame out of the truck and kicked to the surface. He could see a vague light, but he didn't really know if he could make it all the way through the blackness. By the time he broke through, like a bullet coming out of the water, he later described it, he swallowed a stomach full of seawater, and the first thing he did was vomit. Blood was streaming down his face from the gash in his forehead. His leg ached. He was treading water under the intact northbound span of the Sunshine Skyway, sick and scared and gasping for weak, wet breath. A few feet away, just sticking out of the swirling green water, he saw a large segment of silver steel superstructure, so big that one end was on the bay bottom, the other poking through the waves. He managed to grab it and hold himself steady. Through the cold drizzle, McIntyre managed to focus on the broken bridge 1,000 feet away and 150 feet up. He fixated on a pair of bright headlights. That would be Dick Hornbuckle's Buick, right at the dangling edge. So that's what happened.
He tried to
mute the sound of his...
Go ahead.
Are we done?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought you were...
No, you had mentioned the read, but that's basically it. And Wesley McIntyre, who passed away in 1989, spent a lot of time with his family, and his story to me was so compelling because he was the only survivor of this tragedy. But he was consumed with what they call survivor guilt for the rest of his life. He used to go down to the Skyway on the anniversary every year at 7:30 in the morning and wave to the Tampa to Miami Greyhound buses that went by, as if to say, you know, I've got your back. He was consumed with the fact that he couldn't save anybody.
That was the one of the buses that fell in?
Yeah, well, that was the Greyhound bus. Yeah, it was 26 people on it.
Why did it take so long to stop traffic after the accident?
Bruce Atkins, the co-pilot, describes that Mayday call. He was listening to it with me, and he said that was the most frustrating thing, because we're completely helpless standing there watching these cars go over, and the Coast Guard, the person on Channel 16 is saying, well, can you assist? How many people on your vessel? And they're going, why don't you just stop the traffic? You know, we'll sort all this out later, but there's still people coming. Well, if you know the Sunshine Skyway, to get to that point, it's 7.5 miles. So a lot of those cars just were out there, and there was no motorist warning system. There was nothing. Plus, the weather was terrible. So, yeah, they kept coming. And if you know the old bridge, you couldn't see over the top. You couldn't see until you got there that the rest of the bridge was out.
And they've changed that, luckily. There's a motorist warning system now.
Yes, that was part of the... part of what they did when they built the one in 87, the bumpers and the motorist warning system, their video cameras. In fact, the guy who designed that, a guy named Michael Knott, who designed the bumper system, says in my book, he says, you know, we spend more on protecting new bridges now than we usually used to spend on building bridges. It costs so much now.
You mentioned Dick Hornbuckle in that in the passage. Who is he, and why was his yellow Buick so memorable?
Well, it's the iconic photograph from the incident that actually happens to be on the cover of my book. Mr. Hornbuckle was a used car dealer in St. Petersburg, and on some weekends he would drive to South Florida to a town called Sebring, which I'm sure you know, bring some cronies with him, and they'd pick up cars for his lot, and he brought the cronies with him to drive the cars back. So that's what they were doing this morning. And he slammed on his brakes. He describes watching the bus go past him. There's all sorts of things like that. He slams on his brakes once he realizes what happens, and that big yellow Buick stops 14 inches from the edge.
Yep.
Mr. Hornbuckle, after they all get out of there, he realizes the doors have all been left open. So he goes back down the grating, closes all the doors of his car, then gets his keys out and goes into his trunk to retrieve his golf clubs. He's, you know, 150 feet over the bay in the middle of a storm, and this horrible thing has happened. They talked him out of it. They said, you're nuts. Forget your golf clubs. And that car sat in Dick Hornbuckle's driveway until the day he died in, I think it was 2000 when he passed away.
Wow. Our guest is author and journalist Bill DeYoung. His new book is about the Sunshine Skyway disaster. Do you remember that day? Our phone number is 877-428-8255, and we're on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. What was John Laro charged with?
Well, the way it went, there were no criminal charges in those days. It was just decided, I guess, that, you know, it was... that would have been a little bit too much. There was what they call a Marine Board of Inquiry, which was co-conducted by the Coast Guard and the National Transportation Safety Board, essentially to discover exactly what had happened. In the end, they came back and said, well, it was primarily the weather. They said that Laro's hesitation in making the turn doubtless contributed to it. The worst thing that happened to him was the pilot board and the Board of Professional Regulation turned on him, and they revoked his license. They had never disciplined a pilot ever, and they got a lot of criticism for that. So when this happened, they decided, in my view, they were going to make an example out of Laro, and they took his license, and he had to go to court to win it back. A lot of this book takes place in the courtroom.
Did he win it back eventually?
What a raw deal John got.
And did he get the license back?
Well, yes, he got the license back. He piloted for about 6 months, and then he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and he had to retire his license voluntarily. And as you know, it's a debilitating disease, which they believe is exacerbated by extreme stress, and that ruined John's life. It was essentially just a downhill spiral from there for 15, 16 years until he finally died. A lot of my book is about John's story and about Wes McIntyre's story. And the way that this incident, although they both lived through it, it killed them both eventually. Hmm. That was the way I looked at it.
There were also a lot of civil lawsuits filed against John Laro. What happened? What were the typical outcomes of those?
Well, ultimately, the ship owner, Wakwong Shipping out of Hong Kong, was held responsible. And they paid out somewhere along the lines of $300,000. They had to pay the state a lot of money to replace and repair the bridge. They put a lot of money into that, but they also had to pay the victims' families.
No one found John responsible?
There was John. First of all, John didn't have any money. So there was no way they were going to. I mean, Greyhound got involved. I think it says in the book that at one point there were 42 law firms squabbling over the carcass of the Skyway at one time. You know, these civil things. John went back to work. And another thing that's always bothered me, and I love to tell people this too, is people tend to forget. They remember John Laro, and they remember what happened, and how can anybody be so stupid as to hit a fixed object in the middle of the bay, and you know, what's wrong with this guy? But the fact that he was exonerated and went back to piloting didn't seem to get reported on much.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of folks who remember this think, oh, that guy was bad news, you know, but he really kind of wasn't.
Yeah, there were a lot of other factors involved.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you drive over the other span of the bridge after the accident while the southbound span sat crippled next to you?
Many times. Absolutely many times. It was spooky. It was spooky. It was like, you know, I was likening it to sort of a crime scene, and you stumble upon it, but for whatever reason they've the chalk outline is there, but the body is still there. It always made you extremely uncomfortable to see right where it happened every time you drove over.
And now we have the brand new bridge. It's a cable-stayed, sleek design. Every safety feature, we've mentioned a few of them, these bumper islands and everything. Could such an accident happen again? We still have all these freighters going through Tampa Bay. Cruise ships go under the bridge all the time. Could it happen?
Oh, the ships get bigger and heavier every year. I think that the Sunshine Skyway Bridge, I think I'm safe in saying that it's one of the best protected overwater bridges in the world. Could it never happen again? I don't think anybody wants to say that. But it would take, a confluence of some really intense stuff all happening at once. It's a lot safer than it used to be. I think that's the best way to say it.
Why do you think the movie An Act of God was never made about the disaster?
Well, I haven't read the script. I'm actually going to see Mr. Yared in a couple of days up there in Tampa, but he told me he couldn't find it. I have a feeling that it was a big deal for them for a little while, and then things happened, and they sort of lost interest in it. As you notice in the book, Yared says that John Huston had agreed to direct it. And that was actually going to get made. And then when they were, just before they signed the contract, Huston died. And they only had about $10 million in financing. And I have to ask you, what kind of movie is that going to make?
So you're going to try and bring the interest back?
I'm sorry?
Are you going to try and bring the interest back in the movie?
I would love for that to happen. So Steven Spielberg, if you're listening, call me. At the same time, you know, I'm very aware that 35 people lost their lives here, and it's not like, ooh, Bill wants to make a movie out of it. You know, it's a very tragic story. Having said that, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see a film made out of it, because I think there's so much pathos and so much moving human emotion in here, the story of human endurance, that I think it would make a fine film. I do. We just don't want to ever forget, you know, why we're here.
And we talked about Wesley McIntyre, the only, quote, fool who went in the water, end quote, from Chapter 9. He waved to the Greyhound bus every year on May 9th until he passed away.
Yep.
John Laro passed away from multiple sclerosis. What became of the Summit Venture?
Well, the Summit Venture was, it was repaired. There was about $1 million of damage to it from hitting the sky, which is sort of a big dent in the front up on the forecastle. Continued to sail. It was sold and renamed several times. I remember following it. And while I was working on the book, you know, what you end up doing is you check Lloyd's Registry, the ship's registry. You check all your usual sources all the time. And I happened to be looking one day. I realized it had been sold to a Chinese firm called Jinmao. And the ship was then called the Jinmao 9. And I was on Lloyd's one day, and it said, the Jinmao 9 sunk off the coast of Vietnam. This was the end of 2010. I was in the middle of writing the book. It was hit by high winds and massive waves, and it sunk.
And it died, too. Also gone. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill.
Well, thank you for having me, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
Bill DeYoung is a journalist and author of the new book, Skyway, the true story of Tampa Bay's signature bridge and the man who brought it down. Information is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. We'll be back in a moment with John Davis and his guests talking about harmful algal blooms. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.